Okay, a little bit of ground to cover today. I want to make sure everyone has a copy of the notes from last week, the last couple of weeks for our visitors. We have been looking at various texts and translations of the scriptures. We want to strengthen and encourage your commitment to the Word as God's truth. No.
I think it's a different one. I brought the wrong one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. We printed them up. Let's get them out into use. have another one if you'd like. Two. That would be good. Just to give you a little bit of background for our visitors, a number of weeks ago, as Pastor Roy was teaching through 1 John, we came across a passage, a phrase in the scriptures where many of the oldest texts that we have and copies of the scriptures did not include the phrase. And so that raised a question. What's going on there? Why is that in some Bibles and not in others? And so this study attempts to answer that. And just we've been surveying the methods and materials for ancient writing, particularly as it pertains to the scriptures. We've also been surveying how those materials were copied and preserved and so on. And now we've come to a place where we consider the kinds of variants that occur. Many of those, we've covered most of them last week. We just have a couple more today to finish up the kinds of variants, and then we'll move on to some other things. It's just an honest recognition that of all the thousands of manuscripts that we have, no two are alike. And we need to do something with that. We need to evaluate that. How do we respond in light of that? Maintaining our high view of the scriptures, that we believe that the autographs, the original writings, had every single word precisely what God wanted to be there. And so our responsibility is to try to determine, when we have a difference, which is the most likely the original reading. Now again, let's remember that two-thirds of the verses in the New Testament have no variants. There's no doubt as to what every single word is in two-thirds of the verses of the New Testament. So that in itself is remarkable. And of the variants that we have, though there are many, none of them affects a major doctrine. So we're not talking about doubt when it comes to the gospel or when it comes to orthodox doctrine, the Reformed faith. We're not talking about that kind of a problem, but nevertheless we want to survey these things. And a lot of them, I think, as you saw last week, just came about because scribes are cold, they can't see well, they don't hear well, their eye skips a line. Just very simple things like that is the cause of most of these things that we see in the scriptures. Sir?
I just got a comment. I think there's another thing evident in the fact that different languages don't necessarily articulate the English. You know, I know like in a lot of, we lived in Greece for a while, and you know, they have a lot of different gender words that you just can't find a correlating English word that fits.
Right, right. Well, one good example of that occurs in the New Testament, where it says Jesus in the genealogy in Matthew, where it says it mentions Mary, of whom, and that's feminine singular, was born Christ, the Messiah. Now, in English, of whom doesn't have gender, but in Greek it does, and so it's very clear that the genealogy excludes Joseph from the line of the Messiah in terms of his physical descent. So that's a good example of that. That's more of a translation issue than it is a copying text issue. And if you're with us for the next couple of weeks, we'll talk about that in some detail. So hopefully you'll be able to be with us. But let's finish up our kinds of variants that we looked at. Many of the variants are unintentional. They're just scribal mistakes. But some of them are intentional. And we raised the issue that unlike the Jews, the Greek mindset of the time of the copying of the earliest manuscripts of the Greek New Testament, the Greeks did not share this mindset where every single letter is sacred. And even if we know that the word is a mistake, we copy it anyway and we just make a note. We don't tinker with the text at all. The Jews would not do that. But the Greeks felt that, well, you know, this would be clearer if I substitute this more common word for this obscure one. They both basically mean the same. So to make clarity, we'll substitute the word. Well, there's a variant. It's intentionally done. And it's just a mindset that we would not necessarily follow. Hopefully you still have those little slips of paper from last week. If you have Matthew 13:57, please be ready to read that. One of the things that we find that comes through intentional alterations is what we call conflation or mixed readings. Sometimes the different wordings of the Gospels or other passages in the Scriptures would be combined in a certain way. And if a scribe had two different manuscripts which differed, then he might combine both readings, not making a decision as to which one he's going to leave out. Let's just include them both. An example of that, Matthew 13:57. Who has that?
I have it.
Please.
And they took offense at him, but Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and in his own household."
Okay. Now, a word-for-word rendering of the Greek there that does not make smooth English, when you compare that with the other Gospels of Mark and Luke read "in his hometown." A literal reading of Matthew is "in hometown." A prophet is not without honor except in hometown. Mark and Luke say "in his hometown." John 4, verse 44, reads "in own hometown." Now, that's not good English, but that's one of the ways that the Greek can express that. Now, those three different readings were mixed together so that Matthew, in several manuscripts, takes all three of those words, "in his own hometown." Okay? Again, a good example of no doctrinal issue at stake here. It's just trying to be careful and accurate as to which reading is most likely the original. Colossians 1:12. Someone have that?
"Giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to share in the inheritance of the saints in light."
Okay. Some manuscripts read "who has qualified us," as Kathy read. Others read "who has called us." One manuscript, one of the ancient uncial manuscripts that we looked a picture of that, Codex Vaticanus from the 4th century, is the only manuscript that reads "who called and qualified us." So it's just a combination of readings there. Okay, let's move on to doctrinal concerns. Where the scribe perceived a doctrinal problem, he might add or change something to relieve a concern. Matthew 5:22.
"But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, 'Raca,' is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell."
Okay. The phrase in focus here is, "Everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court." Now, Jesus often used hyperbole to emphasize a point. In that very same passage, "If your right eye offends you, gouge it out. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off." Does he really want us to mutilate ourselves? No, he think he's using hyperbole to describe how serious is the situation and how sin must be drastically dealt with. And so possibly this is an example of that. But there was a scribe later who apparently felt that this saying contradicted Ephesians 4:26, which says, "Be angry, but do not sin." Or the behavior of Jesus himself in Mark 3 talks about his behavior in the temple. He looked around at them with anger and drove the traders out of the temple. And so a scribe might come to that and say, well, wait a minute. If Jesus said anyone who is angry is guilty before the court, how do we reconcile that with Jesus' anger or Paul's exhortation to, you know, be angry, but do not sin, as if to give permission for anger as long as it does not become sinful. And so some manuscripts inserted the statement back in Matthew 5, anyone who is angry with his brother without cause. Okay, that comes in later in the 7th century that appears. Also, Matthew 24:36, some scribes couldn't reconcile Jesus' words with his divinity, where he says, "But of that day and hour no one knows," that is the hour when the Lord, when the end will come, "not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father alone." And so a scribe comes to that, well, how can the omniscient, eternal Son of God not know something like that? And so some manuscripts omitted the words, nor the Son. It relieves the doctrinal concern there. And we look at that and we struggle with it too, right? How can Jesus not know the day or the hour? Not sure we have a good answer for that. That's a difficult thing. So we look at Matthew 5:22. Another one is to counter heresies. The copyist might strengthen the orthodox position by altering the text. Luke 2:41-43.
His parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover, and when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast. When they had finished the days, as they returned, the boy Jesus lingered behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother did not know it.
Now, a few manuscripts, the words Joseph and Mary, verse 41, and Joseph and his mother, were substituted for his parents. Now, the Greek says, you hear that Shannon read, his parents. So, usually that word refers to those who physically gave birth to a person, both male and female. And so, because of the desire to protect the virgin birth, they would say, some of the manuscripts read Joseph and his mother. So kind of move Joseph out of the line of descent a little bit. In verses 33 and 48, the word Joseph was substituted for references to Jesus' father. It talks about Jesus' father in those verses. And so there are variants where they just change the word father to the word Joseph, because Joseph is not Jesus' father. Legally he was, or in terms of appearance he was, but in terms of procreation he was not. And so that tension was attempted to be relieved there in those verses by that change. Oftentimes the deity of Jesus and his identity as the Messiah were often strengthened by multiplying his titles. Many variants have to do with places where it's referred to Jesus. Some manuscripts will add Jesus Christ or the Lord Jesus or the Lord Jesus Christ. Those titles strengthen his deity. And of course, many of the early heresies in the church were involved his identity as the Son of God. And so sometimes the variations in the text will just simply serve to reinforce the orthodox position of who Jesus is. Okay? And we have, finally, disturbed texts. Several New Testament texts show major differences among the manuscripts. And this is a good example right here. This is the end of the Gospel of Mark. This is Kata Markon here, according to Mark. And this is the end. And this is the shorter ending. This is called the shorter ending. It just talks about how they left... When they left with great fear. The women left the tomb wondering and with great fear. That's not much of an ending of the gospel, right? It's just, well, wait a minute, what happened? It doesn't tell about the resurrection. It doesn't tell about his appearance to the apostles and the women and so forth. And so there's a longer ending. There's several different endings. Mark 16, some versions end at verse 8. One ends at verse 20. The so-called shorter ending is a different ending from what is often included in our modern Bibles, which is a concluding paragraph after verse 8 instead of verses 9 through 20. Another passage that's considered a disturbed text is the story of the woman caught in adultery. It has weak support for that, and none before the 5th century, and even some manuscripts include the story about the woman caught in adultery, but they put it in a different place in the gospel. And so we need to we recognize that there are a few passages where there are major differences, like the ending of Mark, and you know, that's a tough one to deal with. Your translation may have verses 9 through 20 in brackets included, the longer ending, but in brackets to show that it's very possible that that was not in the original writing. And yet we're left with this kind of strange ending to the gospel if it does indeed end at verse 8. Okay, that's the end of the variations. Any questions there on Bill?
Well, I'm sorry I didn't get the earlier part.
No problem.
Your presentation. But what type of authority was permitted the various versions? Was it just the scribe this is the way the scribe chose it? Or did anyone agree that, yes, that's the way that it should be presented?
I'm not sure if there was individual scribes making these decisions or if this was a consensus decision. Again, like I say, at the time of the early copying of the manuscripts, the Greek cultural mindset did not require absolute perfection, letter by letter, don't dare change a thing. They felt some freedom to change the thing as long as the message was preserved. And so I don't know exactly what the dynamics were for that. But probably both were involved. There were probably some cases where an individual scribe said, this would be much clearer if I change this. Whereas he might other times, if they were in a scriptorium, for example, where one person was reading the text and a room full of copyists were working away, the person reading the text might say, this would be a lot clearer if we substituted this word or if we phrase it this way. And so everybody follows along with that. We don't know.
I can appreciate that. Even, let's say, transferring early American to current American, what I always come up with is gay.
Yeah.
The way that could be translated.
Yeah, the changing of the meaning of words is an issue that comes up in the various translations a lot of times. A lot of those occur in the King James, where the words just aren't used that way anymore. And it leads to some confusion sometimes. And that illustrates the fact that, and we are going to deal with this in more detail in weeks to come, next week particularly, that since the meaning of words change, in order to maintain the clarity of the scriptures, we need to keep translating. We can't translate into English once because the language keeps changing. And so you need to translate in modern English. That's the desire, is that we have the scriptures in the common language. That's always been the desire. That was the motivation behind the translation of the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament. That's the motivation behind the translation of the Vulgate. That's what Vulgate means, common language, the vulgar language. That was why they many of the Tyndale and Coverdale, Wycliffe, that's why they risked their lives in order to have the scriptures in the modern tongue of their times. Yeah. Okay? Now, we're going to pick up some speed. This is kind of necessary details to help you understand, but we don't need to dwell on these things. And so I want to consider various text types. This is before the printing press. These are various types of manuscripts. You might just imagine that as just the mechanical process of copying, that you would tend to have geographic locations where certain types of texts were typical, because you didn't go to all the way across the Roman Empire to find a copy of the scriptures to make a copy over at this end. If there was something nearby, that's what you used and that's what you copied. And so there were general geographic areas where certain texts were typical. So in the course of time, as copies were made, circulated, copied again, manuscripts that shared characteristics of a particular time and or location were categorized. The first of these is the Alexandrian. Scribes who were associated with or employed by the scriptorium associated with the catechetical school at Alexandria, Egypt, who were trained philologists, that's language experts, grammarians, and textual critics. They were the first to attempt to recover the original text in the 2nd century AD. Egypt was a much more stable area in terms of, at this time, in terms of the persecutions, the social upheaval. There was already an established a religious center for both Judaism, and then as Christianity was revealed, Christianity became very prevalent there. And Alexandria was the location of the general location where the Septuagint translation was made, the Jewish translation of the Old Testament scriptures into Greek. Interesting that they are trying to recover the original text in the 2nd century, right? That's the 100s. AD, they already recognized that as these manuscripts were being copied and circulated, differences were starting to show up. And so they were so, wait, we need to make sure that we get a standard text here and that we keep these differences that are cropping up through hand copying from overtaking the text and corrupting it. Mike?
When was the original Old Testament translated into Greek?
That took place between 200 and 300 B.C.
Because Jesus actually quoted the Septuagint.
Yes, Jesus and the apostles quote the Septuagint verbatim, frequently. We're gonna look at that. That in itself teaches us something about translation and how truth can be communicated in different languages. We're going to see that in the weeks to come as well. So the Alexandrian text is typified by Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, also Alexandrinus. Almost all of the early papyrus manuscripts from the 2nd to the 4th centuries are of this type. So this is probably the oldest text type, is the Alexandrian text. Okay, the Byzantine text, this is another group of texts that share generally the same characteristics. It appeared at the end of the 3rd century and grew in popularity until it was the dominant text type throughout Christendom. According to Jerome, whose dates are there, it originated with Lucian of Antioch, who died in 312 AD, as a recension, which is a purposely created edition. Now, this is, again, an important reflection of the Greek mindset. Lucian apparently went through the New Testament and made himself, he was an outstanding theologian and teacher of his time. He went through the whole New Testament and smoothed out a lot of things. And it was enough of a change that it was called a recension, a purposely created edition. It had its own unique characteristics. Okay, that's kind of the beginning of this. And then as that was copied, it became this known as this Byzantine text type. It is characterized by smoothness of language achieved by the removal of obscurities and awkward grammatical constructions and by the conflation of variant readings. Remember conflation, the combination of different readings when they appeared. Notice the removal of obscurities and awkward grammatical constructions. Remember some of our variants included places where the apostles, who were untrained men, they didn't necessarily follow the rules of Greek grammar very well sometimes. And so later scribes would fix the grammar. And that is one of the things that Lucian of Antioch did. The Byzantine text. We need to pause on this for a little bit. And we recognize that most of the manuscripts we have are of the Byzantine text type. And there are some very understandable reasons for that. The abundance of manuscripts of this type is a result of a combination of several factors. The first of these is that during the Diocletian persecutions, which was around 303 AD, many manuscripts were destroyed. Anyway, he was one of the main persecutors of Christianity. And in a systematic fashion, his henchmen went throughout the empire arresting, killing Christians, and destroying their writings. So that, you know, you can kill a person, but if the writings continue, somebody else is going to pick it up and continue with this. And so an important part of the persecution was to destroy the manuscripts. And so the fact that we don't have very manuscripts before this time is very much a result of the fact that those manuscripts were destroyed by persecutors. Now remember that Lucian's version, Lucian of Antioch, his version was done shortly after this time. Okay, right around this time. Another factor, the conversion of Constantine and the Edict of Milan, 313 AD, produced immediate demand for bishops and Bibles. Remember that when Christianity became a legitimate religion in the Roman Empire through the conversion of Constantine, now all of a sudden we don't have any Bibles. That we destroyed them all. And now that we're going to say Christianity is okay, now we need some Bibles. So Antioch in Syria became the source of bishops, the school there, who perpetuated the teaching of the school in that place, and they brought with them copies of Lucian's text. So as Christianity becomes legitimate, now it provides an opportunity. There's a vacuum for Bibles, and what fills that vacuum is this text that Lucian edited. Another factor is the development of the monastic movement, which kind of started very small, mostly individuals, in the 4th century. It did not become systematized in terms of the Benedictine and the Franciscan monks that we know from the Middle Ages. That did not happen until later. But really, the beginning of the monastic movement It started about the 4th century, and that provided a place for scholars and scribes to study and copy the scriptures. That was one of the main things that the monks were about. The stability and spread of the Holy Roman Empire during the Middle Ages brought Roman Catholicism to a wide geographical area, and with it the text that they used, the Byzantine text. And so now as the empire spreads throughout most of Europe, North Africa, even into the Middle East, that's where this text went. Another factor, the 9th century development of a minuscule or cursive script was combined with the use of scriptoria, enabling more copies to be produced in a shorter time. Remember earlier we discussed how it's this minuscule script is a cursive. You can write cursive faster than you can block print, right? And when you use a reader and a room full of scribes, now you can produce a lot more manuscripts quickly. And so that this combination of these factors results in the majority of the manuscripts being of the Byzantine text type. The oldest exemplars come from the 5th and 6th centuries, those particular uncial scripts. We're just going to mention briefly what's called the Western text. This is a popular or uncontrolled text. It's characterized by scribal emendations intended to harmonize accounts, eliminate difficulties, or emphasize a doctrinal perspective. It took basically what Lucian of Antioch did and did it in spades, if you want to put it that way. Exemplars are few since its inferiority was apparent. D from the 5th century, and then apparently a couple of later manuscripts that were copied from that. So there are very few examples of this Western text. It was obviously had been changed a great deal and had a particular doctrinal emphases. So which one's better? Which one are we going to use to base our translation on today? And that's a question that we have to answer. Since the late 19th century, most scholars, influenced by Westcott and Hort, have endorsed Alexandrian priority. Now, that doesn't mean that we throw away all of the other manuscripts. What that means is that we recognize that Alexandrian text type is probably the earliest. It's probably, in general, the most accurate. And so it is weighed, the manuscripts are weighed with that factor in mind. And that's where Roy and I are in terms of accepting the Alexandrian priority, and most scholars today, even since the 1800s, have agreed with that position. The development and application of principles of textual criticism over the last 200 years has produced what is known as the critical text. That just means this is a text that, by engaging in textual criticism, taking into account the way things were copied and all of these errors and trying to determine how they came in and what the more likely the original reading was, that's just a process called textual criticism, and the result of that is the critical text. Now, of course, that's not using criticism or critical in a negative way, as the word is sometimes used. It's just saying that here's the text we have after we go through this process. As best we can understand, this is most likely what the original autographs read. Okay? The critical text is the basis for all modern translations except the New King James. And we're going to talk about why that is as we move on. Now here comes our printing press. Everything changes when the printing press and movable type are invented. And we're going to talk about a fellow who was the first to print a Greek text. And his name, come on up here, is Desiderius Erasmus. There he is. He's the first to produce a Greek New Testament using the printing press in 1516. His dates are there. He is called the Prince of the Humanists. He was a theologian and a philosopher of that time. He's also known as Erasmus of Rotterdam, the main city in the Netherlands with which he was connected. He was educated at the University of Paris, which is an important center of scholasticism. That's the humanistic, rationalistic philosophy of learning that was prevalent at the time. He was influenced by Renaissance humanism. He was ordained a priest, took monastic vows as an Augustinian monk. He was a critic of the Roman Church, but also refused to join the reformers who were contemporary with him. Now, he's kind of an interesting person. You will hear a wide variety of things said about this man as to whether he was a good guy or a bad guy. Some people speak of him in such glowing terms as he was the one who rescued the New Testament text from its corruption, which had happened over the previous centuries. Others will say that he was not a friend of the Scriptures necessarily, but was mainly an opportunist. And I will tell you up front, I tend toward the latter estimation of Erasmus. I'm not sure that his motives were the best, and I'm not sure he had a high view of the Scriptures. If you were going to kind of draw a parallel between this guy, even in our own time, we have conservative Roman Catholics, right? They're in the news these days. They're the ones that are squawking about what the president's doing concerning requiring contraception be provided by all health plans. So you have the conservative Catholics on one side. And on the other side, you have the reformers. That they are the people who have parted with the Roman Catholic Church. They are the ones who are trying to get back to the historic doctrinal positions of the church. They are conservative, too, in that sense. Erasmus didn't fit in with either of those groups. He wasn't happy with the Catholics. He wasn't happy with the reformers. He would probably be more in line and more parallel with what you would have today in a liberal Christian theologian. Somebody who, I mean, he's a humanist. You know, he believes in the ability of human reason to discern truth. And so I suspect that he probably did not have a real high view of the Scriptures. And the way that he produced his printed edition of the New Testament, I think, reflects that. Now, I want to back up here. You remember this? This was the Codex, Aleppo Codex of the Old Testament Scriptures. I wanted to bring this back to you to illustrate again this concern that the Jews had for every single letter of the Scriptures. And I want to point out something that maybe you notice. You see this? I mean, there's little notes here. These are probably just marginal notes, little notes about variants that occur in the text, very low up at the top. But there's some larger words up at the top there. We're going to zoom in on those. Okay? Pastor Roy can probably read those. But the first one over here on this side is the words, Kodesh LaYahweh, holy to the Lord. Holy to the Lord. Where else do we see that? Where else does that phrase occur in Judaism? It was inscribed on a gold plate that was hung on the turban of the high priest, holy to the Lord, right? It also describes the sacrifices. And the Old Testament scribes took that same highest title of worth and put it on their copies of the Scriptures. Holy to the Lord. Okay? Let me look at this one over here. For the sake of time, we won't spend any time in trying to make conjecture as to what that may mean. But it's a word that means lo yimakar. Lo yimakar, not to be sold. It takes the same form as a number of the commandments in the Ten Commandments. You know, lo tignov, no stealing. This says lo yimakor, no selling. This is holy to the Lord. This is not to be made. You don't make merchandise of this. That was the view of the Scriptures, and I have somewhat of the same view today, and I have pause about the multiplication of translations and study Bibles, you know, the Cotton Patch Bible, the Women's Study Bible, there's all of this multiplication of Bibles, and a lot of it, I'm afraid, is intended to make money more than it is to propagate the Scriptures. We have all kinds of copies of Scriptures. We have an abundance of them. Good land, I have about 2 feet of linear space on my bookshelf in my office, which is just Bibles. And so I mention that because I'm afraid that that was one of the concerns that was going on with the production of Erasmus' first printed Greek New Testament. His first edition was edited in only a few months, and I believe it was for the purpose of getting it on the market first. There was some competition coming. The Roman Church was producing what is called the Complutensian Polyglot. polyglot, many tongues. It was a parallel, like this is a polyglot. Here we have Greek and Latin. The Complutensian polyglot was going to include Hebrew in there as well, I believe it was. But it was kind of held up because the Pope hadn't yet put his stamp of approval on it. And so while printing had started in 1514 of this Complutensian polyglot, it was kind of held up, waiting for the Pope to give the go-ahead. And during that time, Erasmus produced his, and he got to the market first. I think he perceived that the market was ripe for this new printing technology to produce a Bible, and so he produced his really quickly. His haste produced innumerable errors. That's one of his contemporaries said that about his Greek New Testament. There are innumerable errors. Erasmus himself later described it as thrown together rather than edited. That's quite an admission right there. Deb?
Is this the same Erasmus that Martin Luther disputed?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he and Luther didn't get along all that well. What he did was he was in a city in Europe, I believe it was Basel, and there were available in Basel only about 6 manuscripts out of all of the at this time there were thousands available if you knew where they were and you could have access to them. He only had 6. They were all basically the same. They had been copied one from another probably because they originated in the same geographical area. And what he did was he took that manuscript, all 6 manuscripts from the 12th and 13th centuries. One of these is a minuscule 2E that is seen here. I think he had hot wings and dip or something when he was handling the pages because he got some smudges on the side there. Here's another a picture of 2E. This is the top of Matthew, of the page with Matthew 16. It shows his additions and the compositor's marks. And this is basically what he did. Took the manuscripts that he had. He wrote all kinds of notes in the margins and crossed out this and added that and sent that to the printer. And then the printer worked from that to typeset the New Testament and then print it. And so a lot of these changes were things that he felt that were in the Vulgate, that he felt was should be included there. And so he added those in the margins. This is an interesting fact here. None of the manuscripts he had had the last 6 verses of Revelation. In fact, the 6 that he worked from did not have Revelation at all. He had to borrow a manuscript from a friend of his that had Revelation, but the last page had been lost. And so the last 6 verses of Revelation, he didn't have access to that in any Greek manuscript. And so he went to his Vulgate and translated back into Greek those last 6 verses. And so, of course, that produced readings in his New Testament that don't occur anywhere else in any of the manuscript evidence. He also translated the Latin into Greek where he preferred the Vulgate's reading. If the Vulgate had a certain reading that he preferred, then he would translate that into Greek and put that in the text that he sent to the printer. Another man named Stephanus. Those years there are the editions that he produced. And Theodore de Beza, 9 editions between 1565 and 1604. They all produced, many editions, all based on Erasmus' work. So once Erasmus put his text together, then these other editions were printed based upon that work. The Elzevir brothers produced 7 editions between 1624 and 1678. This is the title page from the 1633 edition. The preface of the Elzevir 1633 edition, remember this is over 100 years after Erasmus produced his first copy. The preface of this edition contained the words in Latin which translate the text which is now received by all, in which we give nothing changed or corrupted. This is the source of the common title Textus Receptus, which is abbreviated as TR. You can probably see Textum Receptum. That's where that title Textus Receptus comes from. Or if you want to anglicize the pronunciation, Textus Receptus. The primary text behind the King James and the New King James were Beza's editions of 1588 and 1598. By this time, many of Erasmus, I would probably say most of Erasmus' errors had been corrected, but the text was still basically 12th to 13th century Byzantine. He's kind of a nasty-looking guy, isn't he? That's Theodore de Beza. Now the critical text. I'm going to really move fast here because the point I want to make is that at a certain point, I would say contemporary with the use of the Textus Receptus and its printing by the thousands, there were some scholars who recognized this text is not our best. It is not our oldest. And so they began evaluating texts with a view toward trying to discern what the oldest readings were. Johann Albrecht Bengel, please correct me, Helene, if I don't pronounce the names right. There are a lot of good German scholars here. He was a Lutheran pietist and Greek scholar. He produced a 1734 edition of the Textus Receptus, but he re-edited Revelation, paying special attention to Alexandrinus, which is a manuscript now known to be excellent in the book of Revelation. Johann Jakob Wettstein, Swiss theologian. Pardon?
Wettstein,
thank you. You want to say it right. Swiss theologian and Greek scholar. He produced a 1751 Greek New Testament using more than twice as many manuscripts as Erasmus. And you can see in his title page here, he says, with variant readings, codex manuscripts, older editions, versions, and the fathers. Consulting the early writings of the church are called the fathers. Johann Jakob seems to be a very popular name. Griesbach. He's a German biblical textual critic. He produced a Greek Testament that has been reprinted as recently as last year. That's how good his work was. It has been recognized as being very good quality. Karl Lachmann. He's the first major editor to break completely from the Textus Receptus. He recognized the primacy of the Alexandrian text type. But his purpose was not necessarily to get back to the autographs. He wanted to get back to a 4th century text, which is interesting. I'm not really sure why he did that. Now we have Konstantin von Tischendorf. He deciphered Codex Ephraemi Syri Rescriptus, a 5th century palimpsest. A lot of big words there. This was kind of an interesting little tidbit in the textual history. That particular codex, a palimpsest, is a copy of the scriptures which has been erased and then used for something else. That's what rescriptus means. It's been rewritten. And this man was able to discern what the erased text was, which came from the 5th century. And so that's an interesting achievement in his life. He's the one who discovered Codex Sinaiticus and 20 other uncial manuscripts. Remember the story about the convent? I guess it was a convent on Mount Sinai. Convent? I think so. Anyway, there was an ancient manuscript that was discovered there. His edition was reprinted as recently as 1965. Another some very good quality work there. Now we come to Westcott, who was a professor at Cambridge, Bishop of Dunham, and his sidekick, his straight man, Fenton John Anthony Hort, also a professor at Cambridge. Together with Westcott, they produced an edition of the New Testament in 1881. They further developed principles of textual criticism. Now we come to Eberhard Nessel. One of the weaknesses with Tischendorf was that he had a particular preference for Sinaiticus. I mean, he had discovered it. He thought that was probably the best manuscript out there. Westcott and Hort had a preference for the Alexandrian text type, which in general is good, but they overused it. And so sometimes their readings weren't all that great because of their bias. Now what he did was he built on their work, but he eliminated their biases. And so he was able to produce a text of even better quality than theirs. His work was taken up by Kurt Aland, and has been printed in 27 editions to date. If you go to seminary, you will buy one of these, and that's the Nessel-Alan text. This is the 26th edition. It has now been printed in the 27th edition. And if we had time, I could pass that around so you could look at all the scratchings on there and maybe arouse your interest in learning Greek. So, we're going to stop there. A hopefully not too much information to simply inundate you, but I wanted to give you a brief overview of the main people involved and the things that were happening in the transmission of the text from the printing press on to the present day. The bottom line is that through a lot of good scholarly work, we have in these new editions of the critical text, we have we can be very confident is as close to the original autographs as we can possibly get. There's been a lot of men smarter than me who have worked their whole lives at studying manuscripts and studying copying processes and coming up with what is most likely the original reading here. And so we have total confidence that this is what God wanted us to have. But yeah, there still might be some issues in there, but we have eliminated them as much as we possibly can. So we can have confidence that we have a Greek New Testament that when we translate it faithfully into English, we are going to have truth, capital T truth, from God. Now, I also want to disclaim, I'm not saying that the Textus Receptus or the translations based on that, they are not wrong. They are not bad translations. Even the opportunistic efforts of in haste of a guy like Erasmus, even that can't destroy the scriptures. There is God's truth is preserved in the Textus Receptus. It's also preserved in the translations that are based upon it. I don't want to deny that at all. Okay, just to make that clear. We're not talking about a test of faith here. We're not talking about truth versus error. We're just talking about the greatest degree of care and accuracy that we can possibly have. That's what we're after here. Okay. Next time we're going to look briefly at how textual criticism is practiced, just to give you some general principles by which we discern, make the decisions in the text as to which reading is which one we prefer. And then after that, we'll move on into some discussion about translation process itself, and then finally a brief evaluation of modern translations. Okay, so let's stop here and close with a word of prayer. Lord, we do thank you for your word, and I pray that this study would not shake anyone's confidence, but quite the opposite, to build our confidence in your word as truth from you, that we can read and study and love and live. So help us to do that, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.